I'm standing on the ancient battlements of Castel de Belver, on a high hilltop, overlooking the magnificent city of Palma de Mallorca, vibrant capital of the Balearics, an island group in the Mediterranean Sea, which washes the shores of Morocco, Spain, France, Italy, Croatia, Greece, and many other great seafaring nations. Arrayed before me, along Palma's waterfront and onward to the town of Arenal, are tens of thousands of boats. There are juggernauts stacked with containers, cruise ships packed with tourists, ferries, freighters, mega yachts, motorboats, super yachts, sailboats, dinghies, dories, kayaks, sculls, and skiffs. Plus, of course, the ubiquitous yacht, the traditional double-ended fishing boat of these islands. Boats are this city's business: building, maintaining, repairing, refitting, and of course, selling them. And Palma has become, has perhaps always been, a world-renowned centre of excellence for sailing and for naval craftsmanship. So there's really no better place in the world to launch Boat Radio, a station for boat owners and sailors, water sports enthusiasts, armchair adventurers, and ocean lovers everywhere. Each week, there'll be programmes from the Arctic Circle, the Bahamas, Florida, Missouri, Australia, the United Kingdom, Italy, Croatia, Mallorca, and a dozen other places, as well as from the cockpits and wheelhouses of boats.
Hello, I'm Captain Bob May from Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show, and you're listening to Boat Radio.
Each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames, from the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel, to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures.
Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, boat builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea.
We'll hear compelling tales and inspiring stories from often ordinary people who've done extraordinary things.
We did find an iceberg, but there is no such thing as smooth sailing when you're going north or when you're sailing as much as Ben and I do.
We'll be joined by many of the most prominent names from the fields of sailing, exploration, and endurance sports.
Mark getting a nice puff of breeze on Taylor Canfield, leading Ian Williams. He's in the black boat, jibing now.
We'll delve into the glamorous world of the super yacht.
Summer comes around, we're ready to go, and all the boats start arriving back from the Caribbean, and we all get together third week of June.
But we'll also learn how to live off-grid, aboard a more modest vessel.
I'm one of those lucky guys that didn't have to try and convince his wife to go on their sea dreams. I was thrilled with the idea of living on the boat.
We'll attend classic regattas at some of the most picturesque sailing locations on Earth.
I'm standing in the Fort Adams State Park in Rhode Island, looking back across the water to the city of Newport, sparkling in the early morning sunshine.
And we'll hear from scientists in some of the most forbidding environments.
Welcome to Ocean Research Project. My name is Matt Rutherford, and I am here in Sisimiut, Greenland.
There'll be recommended routes, anchorages, and marinas. There'll be practical tips, medical advice, accurate weather forecasts, and, in addition, an indelible streak of marine conservation. And we'll hear from you, I hope, listening at home or at work, perhaps afloat somewhere. So, welcome to Boat Radio. We're glad you can join us in promoting and celebrating the wonderful world of boats.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm James Finlayson, and this is The Life Aquatic. Each week, The Life Aquatic will feature the story of someone who lives their life on board a boat, who has left dry land behind and has committed themselves to a life on water with all the challenges and all the rewards that that brings. This week, we travel to the south of the USA, close to the Gulf of Mexico, where Gil and Deb Lotka live aboard their Formosa sailing vessel, Dream Chaser. The Formosa is a boat with classic lines that can remind you of pirate ships and Spanish galleons. But for all its beauty, it has also brought Gil and Deb a series of challenges as they take on the enormous amount of work needed to restore the Dream Chaser to its full glory. They've documented their efforts in a series of blog posts and YouTube videos which have helped the boating community learn how to fix and repair a whole host of issues, as well as gaining an insight into life on board a boat with two young grandchildren. I started by asking them where they were currently moored.
We're in Louisiana, in the southern part of the United States. We are in a little hurricane hole right now. It's, you know, if you're familiar with the geography here, from the Gulf of Mexico, we can get into a fairly large lake. It's about 26 miles by 50 miles wide. It's a pretty good freshwater lake. And north of that is a river that feeds into it called the Chifuncta River. So we're about 6 miles up this river. You know, during hurricane season, it's a great little place to go. In the past, when hurricanes have come through this part of the country, there's been very little damage to boats. So not a bad spot to be parked. And it just happened to be where this boat was. So we are still here doing some work on it.
Yep.
Let's talk about the boat. Just tell us all about the boat.
So what we bought was a 51-foot Formosa. It definitely was in our price range at the time because it needed a lot of work.
Yeah, more work than we thought.
We came to the boat looking at it. Actually, we had some friends that were looking for a boat similar to this, and we thought, oh, we like the area. What the heck? It's a five-hour drive. Let's take a weekend trip. No intention of buying it, more just coming to gawk and look, because the Formosa is a boat that both me and Gil have said later in our cruising life, it's definitely the one that we want to own. We knew the Gulf Star was our first starting boat. We just didn't expect to be able to find one that we could afford right now. So we came to look at her, and on the way home, we called our friends, told them about it, and they came up the next weekend. I was telling them, hey, have you looked at the website? Did you look at the boat? And she's like, no, I don't think we're going to. And so me and Gil talked, and next weekend, another drive out here, and then an offer was made, and then 2 weeks later, we were standing on it doing a sea trial.
Wow, so quite a quick process for, I guess, a life-changing decision.
It was. The whole process, start to finish, was probably more realistically like about a month, because there was a two-week period between when we first looked at it and we went, do we really want to do this? We just literally finished refitting 2 or 3 months prior to that our Gulf Star from stern to bow. I mean, we did the whole thing. We knew looking at this going, all right, we've met other people that have had boats like this. We've seen what they've had to do. We've looked at it. And are we really wanting to do that? Or do we want to sit and relax the fruits of our labor from the other boat? So we'd said, well, let's go look at it one more time. And luckily it was raining the day that we looked at it. So we called the broker and he said that it's unlocked. Go spend as much time on it as you want. And I'll come over when I'm done doing what I'm doing this morning. So we came down here and sat and we looked at the leaks and thought, okay, they're not as bad as we expected, you know, because the shape she was in, she's not in pristine shape in any way. And she's a step above the Wanderer in the movie Captain Ron, but she's very close to the beginning boat in that movie.
Looking back, you obviously knew there was work to be done. Is it the case now with hindsight there was more than you thought? Was it a bigger project than you thought you were taking on?
No, I wouldn't say that it's bigger than we thought we were taking on, but I think our reality of our skill set has set in that it's taking us a lot longer than we expected. Because based on what we did with the last affair, when we went through to replace wood panelings and things like that, we pulled them out, cut new pieces, put them in, installed them. On this one, because it is a bigger boat, it's definitely more wood. They're definitely taking us a lot longer than we expected.
And James, I'd add to this. I wouldn't say that there's been more work than we anticipated. The work has just been a little bit harder than maybe we anticipated. So
yeah.
It reminds me oftentimes, if you go to the grocery store and at the checkout, they have all the candy bars and gums and they want you to get the impulse buy. We almost did this on an impulse buy. We've always loved a Bill Garden designed boat. So we bought it a little bit on a whim and certainly don't regret it in any way, shape, or form. But I wish we could have done the work a little faster, because we're a year and a half into owning this boat. And we probably are only 15% of the way done with the refit work. And in the past, we sort of assumed it would take us a good 2 years. I think the reality is setting in that it could be 4 or 5 by the time we finish it. The interesting thing is living aboard while you do a refit makes it that much harder, right?
Because
you have to really organize and put things away, work on a small area, and focus on the next. So it requires a little bit of discipline and certainly some organization.
Which is new for us, because on the Gulf Star, we actually had an apartment. So at the end of the day, we could leave all the tools out, walk away, come back the next morning, pick up where we started. Here, it's like, okay, you leave the stuff out. Well, you can't cook. You can't sit. You pretty much have to clean up every night at the end of the repairs. So it definitely adds a little bit of a learning curve to it.
If I could just take a step back before we talk a bit more about life on the boat. You were saying you always wanted a Bill Garden designed boat. What's special about those boats?
So if you've ever seen a Bill Garden designed boat, they're very classic lines. So if you think about a clipper bow boat, it has the long sweeping bow with a bowsprit. You can often, like on this boat, if we're standing out on the bowsprit, we're a good 12 feet above the water. So it has this raking rise in the bow. Very classic lines. A lot of times you'll see wooden scroll work. You know, it's a fiberglass hull boat, but it'll have wooden scroll work along the teak caff rails. And when you see a classic sailboat in a movie, it's usually a Formosa or a CT. It's a Bill Garden design boat. So the boat in the movie Captain Ron, any sailor loves the Captain Ron movie. You know, it's going to happen out there, boss. It's going to happen out there, boss. That boat was the exact same year, make, and model of this one that we have. The movie with Adam Sandler called 50 First Dates.
That was a Formosa.
They're just really beautiful, classic lines. This one happens to be a cutter rig catch, so there's quite a bit of sail choices you have. If you don't want to raise the mainsail, you can just kind of run with the jib and the mizzen and certainly make it a little bit easier to handle the sails if there's any kind of wind. So that's some of the things we love about them. There's beautiful, classic lines.
And down low, it has a different aspect. Some of the newer boats, and I'm not knocking them anyway, they're really nice, but there's a lot of white. There's a lot of plastic look to them. So when you go down into the Bill Gardens, you have like the solid wooden teak doors. You've got a lot of teak, a lot of woodwork. On the Formosas, they actually have, a lot of the doors have hand-carved doors on them.
So I guess you feel like you've got a link to, let's say, maritime history with one of these boats.
Exactly.
It's a great way to describe it.
It really is. Yeah. You know, you've got a lot of classic history in these boats, and you just feel it when you get on them, I think.
Coming back to the practicalities of living on this boat, is it just the two of you on there?
No, in the beginning it was just the two of us, which made it a little bit easier. But about 6 months ago, our two granddaughters joined us. One is 10 and one is 2. So that has definitely added a new aspect to our plans and the way we do things, especially with the big age difference between the girls. So we've had to adjust a lot of our plans. Probably by next summer, we were planning on sailing it down to Florida. That changed as the girls came, the 10-year-olds in school, so we don't want to keep moving her from schools to school. So we'll stay here a little bit longer. Like Gil was saying earlier, it is a nice hurricane hole, and they're enjoying it. The 2-year-old, she adjusted quite nicely to the boat. The 10-year-old has been on, we've had sailboats her whole life, but never lived aboard. You know, we'd spend weekends and stuff. So for her, I think the space issue was a big adjustment, learning where she can play with things and not being able to spread out and constantly having to pick up after herself. That's, I think, her biggest downfall is we're always telling her, remember, if you get it out, you have to put it away.
Yeah, it's hard enough in a big house. So, yeah, I can only imagine on a boat. With a small child, do you ever feel like there's an extra element of danger, or is she very conscious of the space and what might happen?
We're always cautious of it, certainly. I would imagine it,
she's
too.
Not.
Yeah, too. She's just so trusting. She just assumes nothing could ever happen that's bad. So, you know, we have a lot of rules on the boat as far as if you go up on deck, you have to have a life jacket. So if she's down below, obviously she doesn't. But as soon as she goes up on the deck, she has to have a life jacket on. Because we live aboard, right, we get on and off the boat anytime we're getting ready to head somewhere. So we've got a little bit lax. If we're going to take her off the boat, we will carry her up the companionway steps and then off the boat while we're with her. But if she's going to be, you know, on the ground or on the dock or on the deck, she absolutely has a life jacket. And by starting her young, she doesn't even think twice about it. As a matter of fact, if we get ready to head up the companionway steps, she runs and gets the life jacket. So it doesn't mind wearing it, which is great.
So if we take a step back in time, how did the two of you meet, and were boats involved from the very beginning?
No, not necessarily. We actually met 27 years ago. Actually, we worked for a company called EDS, and we met while at work. We had like runabout boats, like you'd go fishing in and just take the kids out in when they were younger, but nothing like as extensive as a sailboat. I think for ours, most of the time we did RVing. We had a little pop-up camper, and my parents had an RV, so we did more of that than we did the boating when the kids were little. And then as they got older and we began to have a social life again, when we're not carting them around to different practices and stuff, one of Gil's employees actually had a sailboat, and that got me hooked. I can't speak for Gil, but it definitely did me the night that we went out sailing with him, because in my line of work, summertime and stuff is a very, very stressful time. And for me, I just could feel all the work stress go away. So I started thinking, I really want a sailboat.
But so, we didn't start sailing until about nine years ago or so.
Yeah.
So it was fairly recent for us.
Talk us through the boats that you've owned and the progression up to where you are now.
As Deb said, as the kids got older and, you know, they started doing their own thing, you know, just after high school, we started looking for things that we could do again, like when we were younger, right? Our own social life. And, you know, that friend of ours that had the boat, he introduced us to sailing, and we started looking around for boats. The first sailboats we were looking at were like 25-foot Catalinas, now that sort of size.
They're like 22 to 24.
We even looked at a few 22s, and I think the boat he took us out sailing on was a little 20 or 22 foot McGregor, if I remember correctly. And we started looking at a couple of those, and it was funny, as soon as we got on board, all of a sudden we started getting a little bit pickier. We're like, ooh, you know, we'd really like to have a head. If we're going to go on the weekend, we'd like to make sure there's a restroom and, you know, maybe a little bit more standing room. So we sort of quickly ruled out the 22s. We looked at 25 Catalinas, and if we had a pop top, we thought that would be good. Then we looked at a 27, and we said, well, it's amazing the amount of difference in a 27 foot. So we started looking in that 27 foot range, and the first sailboat we bought was a 30 foot Laguna. Not Lagoon catamarans, but a Laguna monohull. Yep. It was pretty wide. It had a good wide berth on it for a 30-foot boat. So there's quite a bit of room down below. You know, it had a head and a V-berth, and the settee folded down into a bed and had a nice U-shaped settee. So it had quite a bit of space and a little galley in it. And that was the one that we purchased and moved to the lake where our friend had taken us sailing.
Only because Gil told the broker, because every time I went on a bigger boat, I'm like, yeah, I can't do a 24. I want to look at the 27.
Yeah.
He told the broker, he said, 30 is the cap. You're not allowed to show her, because every time you show her a bigger boat, she won't look at smaller ones.
Was that on lakes or on the sea?
All lake sailing, yeah. We were near Dallas, Texas, and it was a lake called Lake Louisville. Not a very big lake. It was kind of interesting. I was shocked at the size of the, even power boats that were on this lake. Some of them were 65-foot power boats on this little lake, a little inland lake that went nowhere. But yeah, it was all lake sailing, and honestly, the first 2 years, we did very little sailing. I think we basically used it like a lake house the first couple of years. And we would go to the marina, and the social life was just phenomenal. We had formed great friendships, lifelong friends, met people
with our
met people that have lived aboard, and some that cruised the Caribbean, and we travel with them even still today. So it ended up being this unbelievable camaraderie that we just fell in love with, and working with the folks there. Honestly, I've told people this before when they always say, oh, is it hard to sail? I learned from Sailing for Dummies. I mean, I kind of read that book and watched some YouTube videos and hung out with some friends that had boats, and that's pretty much how we initially learned to sail.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames. From the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel, to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures, I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places, and boarding the ships that work this mighty, muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.
Ah, this is Edward Smith from OPA Racing.
This is Ken Little, president of GLOC Performance Boat Challenge.
Hi, this is Frank Pillsbury with Marine Max and the DFW International Boat Show in Dallas, Texas.
We explore all kinds of boating topics on Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show. Hi, I'm Captain Bob May. We get underway, making way, Saturday evenings here on Boat Radio.
This is Heather Lohe, Director of Membership for Boat US. Thanks for listening to Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm James Finlayson, and this is The Life Aquatic. Each week in this programme, we'll talk to people who have left dry land behind and have committed to living their lives on a boat. I'm talking to Gil and Deb Lotka, who live on board a classic Formosa sailing vessel named Dream Chaser, and document their efforts in fixing it up on their blog and in a series of YouTube videos. In the first part of the programme, you heard them explain how they came to love sailing on the lakes of Texas. I asked them about those lakes, as inland sailing isn't something you perhaps associate with the Lone Star State.
In that part of North Texas, you know, it's the country, right? So, you know, it's people that have boats to go fishing and duck hunting and things like that. And then, you know, on each of the lakes, there would be a smattering of sailboats. For example, this marina that we were in had, I think, 1,000 or 1,100 wet slips that were covered. And of those slips, there were probably about 40 that were sailboats. That's it. So very, very few in the inland lakes. You know, as we talk about later when we move to Kima, that's absolutely a sailing capital of Texas, down in the Galveston Bay, which has, you know, access out to the sea. But yeah, inland lakes, not a whole lot of sailing at all.
as you say, it's mostly just about going up for the weekend and sitting around, having a few drinks, a barbecue, talking to people, just kind of taking it easy.
You just described every weekend for the first 5 years of our boating experience.
Pretty much, yeah. And, you know, that group of people actually had sailboats, and so we might take ours out one weekend, and then one weekend we decide to go out on, you know, our friend Obar's boat, or sometimes we take two or three of them out and just anchor out and cook. And we didn't leave the dock as much as most people would have expected us to, but we did get out there and do stuff. And we met some of the friends that had power boats, and he always liked to go out on the power boat. So a bunch of us would jump on there for a couple hours and, like you said, come back and hang out at the dock. And they pretty much, you know, we still to this day refer to them as our lake family. I mean, we've done vacations with them. We did the BVI trip with our dock mates and stuff. So, in fact, one of the couples that actually has their date to depart next year to go cruising. So, you know, there's been a couple couples that we're all doing the same thing. They're just a little bit ahead of us on their plans to be able to actually take off and do the cruising aspect of it.
So from there, did you get a bit more ambitious about where you wanted to take the boat? What got you down to the sea?
For us, what got us down there is I really liked the aspect of living on the boat. Gil would travel a lot for work. So there was a lot of times that when the kids got older, and I mean by older, both out of school working, and me sitting at home, I'd be like, this is boring sitting at the house by myself. So I would pack up and, you know, it was a 20-minute drive for me to get to work. And as long as I wasn't on my on-call schedule, I could be outside of the city limits. So there were a few nights that I'd go down and stay on the boat. And there was a few people that lived aboard. And I really thought, you know, we have this house that we literally use our master bedroom. We don't cook in the house anymore. The kids are never there. So let's see if we could do this. And so we talked about it. And I just became enamored with being able to just sit on the water. It was, for me, it was very calming. I was much happier being on the water than on land. And I've been that way growing up. Every time my parents had the little runabout boats, I was always in the water.
So, James, I'm one of those lucky guys that didn't have to try and convince his wife to go on their sea dreams. You know,
no,
she really helped push me. I kept thinking, well, this is something we can do when we retire. We can't do it now.
And I'm like, why not?
Yeah, she was.
We're doing it anyway.
She had the realism of, you know, you've got a flexible job. Does it really matter where you sit each day when you work? I'm like, no, you're right. It really doesn't, you know, and it was really kind of freeing, actually, for her to bring it up. It was sort of a relief. I didn't know for sure if she would like the idea of it, and I was thrilled with the idea of living on the boat.
So your job's one where if you've got an internet connection, you can do the job?
Yeah, for the most part it is. I do travel still quite a bit to go to see customers and prospects and whatnot. You know, I work for a company that's been really, really wonderful about this because they know I live on the boat. They know I may be in one city this 6 months, and next year I may be somewhere else. As long as I'm somewhat close to an airport and I can get to where I need to go, they don't mind at all, and it's been tremendous.
That does sound like a dream, yeah.
Our biggest challenge is when we start thinking of where we want to go, one of the top priorities for me is it by a decent-sized airport?
So you've made the decision to go and live on the boat. From the lake where you were, could you actually sail that particular boat down to the sea?
We were landlocked on Lake Louisville. And once we both decided that, you know what, we would like to do the live aboard aspect of it, we started kind of, in the beginning, casually looking to see what style boats we liked. Because even with buying the Laguna, it was the same thing. Gil was out of town. I called him and said, hey, I kind of put an offer in on a boat that they accepted. So you want to go look at one this weekend? And so after we got the boat and we started living aboard, we started looking at more practical things that would be nice for us to have. And one of the big things for me was it had to have two cabins. Because when Gil does work from home, it gave him an aspect of being able to go someplace, close it off, and I'm still able to putter around the boat or do whatever I wanted to do. And the other aspect of, we're really talking about living on, you know, 300 square feet. Sometimes you just got to get away from the other person for a couple hours.
Yeah.
That extra space. And so we started doing Excel spreadsheets. I think I did one more than Gil did.
Yeah, you were definitely the tracker.
And, you know, looking at, this is what I like, this is what I don't like, and then we kind of compromised, and he did one, and I did one, and we had our would-like-to-have list, and then these are the must-have lists.
So what was on the must-have list?
For me, the must-have list was the center cockpit, mainly because you got the bigger aft cabin.
Yeah, you had the separate living area, right? So at center cockpit gives you a separate stateroom and head, usually, that's separate from the boat. We used to joke, always love you, but I always like you. Sometimes got to get 10 feet away from you, you know? And that allowed us to do that. So that was one for sure. I think the other one we both had was it had to have two heads. We met some friends that said the only reason they survived cruising was because they had separate bathrooms. They used to joke about that. So we said, ooh, that must be important.
Yeah. And then the other thing that for me that was a must-have was the U-shaped settee to be able to sit at and eat. And then that way you're not having to have your table set up around the mast and swing around the mast to get around things. You could actually have that. We liked the center cockpit because most of it was based on experience. Our friends had a Morgan that had a center cockpit, and it was nice to be able to sit in that area. It gave you a little bit more of
dry
an outdoor
and stable
porch area, you know, where you could have more people. The center cockpit seemed to have a little more room than some of the aft cockpits did. But my main reason for wanting the center cockpit was the bigger aft stateroom, which we found in the Formosas that even on the aft cabin, you still have the bigger bed. You know, like our bed back there is a full-size bed. And we still have plenty of room for, like, little seating areas. The two-year-old has a bed back there also of her own. It's a little bit smaller than a crib mattress, but not much. So, you know, we still have the big-size room with the storage.
So, James, you asked about the must-haves. It's interesting. We learned an interesting lesson on this. Our Laguna had a U-shaped settee. And when we were looking for the larger boat, right, we had this sort of list of things that we wanted. And we ended up compromising on one of them. And the next boat, the Gulf Star, the Last Affair was the name of the boat, did not have that U-shaped settee.
It had everything but that.
Yep. And it was funny as we moved aboard and we loved the boat, right? But it's funny that one of those things that we initially thought was a really strong desire to have, we ended up compromising because it seemed like it wasn't a huge deal all of a sudden when we wanted that boat. And I think in hindsight, we should have stuck with our guns, right? We should have stuck with our original thought. There was a reason we wanted that. And, you know, we love the boat, but certainly would have preferred that little feature that was important to both of us.
Yeah, it's almost something you wouldn't expect to be the top of a boat owner's list, a U-shaped settee, but there it is.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes a difference when you're talking about walking through, you know, a 2-foot hallway and now you're having to swing around a table if you're carrying stuff. Because a lot of times in the size boats that we were looking at that time frame, the mast was usually right off to the side or right down the center of the walkway in the salon area. So in this particular boat on the Gulf Star, we did not put the table up because we thought, okay, well, we'll put the table up and we'll just leave one leaf up and leave the other one down. But it's amazing, even having it down, how much room that took away. You know, you'd have to hold on to the mast and kind of swing around it.
Yeah, to paint the picture for people that aren't familiar with it, so a lot of these boats I prefer as shotgun setup. So down below, you know, it'll be 10 or 11 feet wide, and there will be a sort of settee or couch on either side, and the mast coming right down through the center of the boat. So you have, between the seats, you have about a 3-foot or so walkway with 8 inches or so of it taken up right in the center with a mast. A lot of them will have a table that connects to the mast with two leaves that fold up so that you can sit on either one of those settees at a table. But it really does take up quite a bit of space right in the center of the room. And like I said, we never even put the table up. We would just sort of eat on your lap if you were going to sit down there, and it just was easier.
We had TV trays sometimes we'd set up, yeah. And it was to the point when we were doing the refit that we both realized that that U-shaped settee was such a big deal for us. We actually took about a week kind of thinking, okay, if we took out this cabinet behind the settee, you know, we could make a small table where you could sit, you know, three people at it. We couldn't do a full U-shape, but we could do, you know, a head to table and then one in the middle. And then we started looking at the logistics of, you know, but then that's a lot of storage space we lose by doing that. But it was such a big deal that it was actually a consideration
we were willing to
consider putting, you know, modifying the boat. We were already gut eater anyways.
Yeah, yeah. When you're comparing it to living on land, it's just the smallest bits of space can make a huge difference on a boat.
Exactly. It really can. It really can.
So that would my one thing, you know, and people always ask, you know, hey, if you had to do this again, what would you do? I said I would not compromise on my wants versus my needs because it really, like for us, it made a big difference.
Earliest prehistory reveals mankind's innate connection to the sea, from boats of woven reed in Egypt to Homer's black ships of the Trojan War, down to the naval battles of Greece, Rome, and every civilization since. I'm Brandon Huebner, and I'll present the history, archaeology, and literature that connect us with our past on the sea. All that on the Maritime History Program. Join me as we voyage down through the ages and witness the development of sailing, trade, and much more. The Maritime History Program, with me, Brandon Huebner, every Wednesday here on Boat Radio.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm James Finlayson, and this is The Life Aquatic. Each week in this programme, we'll talk to people who have left dry land behind and have committed to living their lives on a boat. I'm talking to Gil and Deb Lotka, who live on board a classic Formosa sailing vessel named Dream Chaser, and document their efforts in fixing it up on their blog and in a series of YouTube videos. Earlier in the programme, you heard how Gil and Deb discovered a love of sailing on the lakes of Texas and gradually decided what their dream boat would be like. Finally, it was time for them to move to the coast, a big step towards living on a boat full-time.
We were living in Dallas at the time. We put our house on the market. We sold the house, and we moved into a small two-bedroom apartment right next to the marina at first, before we moved aboard.
That was my idea, because pretty much I'd lived on my own before, because I had the two kids and got divorced early on. Gil had lived with his mom at the time when we met, so when we met, we got married, we bought a house. So Gil never even lived in an apartment.
Yeah, I always went from living at home to married with two kids.
Yeah.
At so, a very young age.
I was concerned that I'm like, I've lived in a small space before, and I was really worried because Gil, even when we looked at getting the apartment, he's like, but it has to have a garage. I'm thinking, where's there a garage on a boat?
Yeah.
No, there's not one. So I said, let's put the house on the market. It'll sell faster being empty. It'll get the kids to move out because our son wasn't wanting to. So we just told him, look, you're old enough, you're an adult, we're, you know.
House is up for sale, here's the date we're moving.
Yeah,
so
gotta get out.
From there, though, we moved into this apartment, and we were finding ourselves driving quite a bit from Dallas down to Kima, Texas, which is the southern part of Texas. It's right on Galveston Bay, just off the Gulf of Mexico, so it's open to big water. And we were finding ourselves driving down there quite a bit and looking at boats.
About every 3 months.
Yeah.
We'd go down with a list.
We'd go look at some boats and whatnot, and that's when Deb really was sort of pointing out, like, hey, listen, the job's flexible. We could easily just live there instead of driving down there. Because at one point, it got to where we were driving down there at least every month.
Yeah.
About a 5.5 to 6 hour drive from Dallas down. So we decided to go ahead and move down there. We just got an apartment there, and we trucked the 30-foot Laguna, the sailboat, down there to Kima. And we figured, yeah, over the next few years, maybe we'll find a boat. And then we found the Gulf Star just a few months after we moved there. So
it went quickly because I retired from, I was an animal control officer, and pretty much being on call all the time was getting to me. So I retired in November, and that's when we pretty much said, hey, we could do this. And Gil's like, yeah, we could. So he went out of town, came home the next, when he came home from his business trip, I had my Excel spreadsheets going, well, this is what it would cost to move. Here's some apartments I found that I'd like to look at. Because what we were finding is when we would drive down to Kima with our list of boats, they were either already sold or under contract. So, you know, we wanted to see all these boats, but trying to travel down there to see them just wasn't working.
And can you paint a picture of what Kima's like and what sort of a place it is and how many boats are down there?
You know, it reminds me of kind of a coastal cruising community. You've got Houston around you with all the big city and everything, and then you, I tell people, I said, I lived in vacation land. That's the best way to describe it. I mean, there was a few areas that they had, quote, beaches. They weren't really beaches, but it was just stuff that people done, you know, for kids to swim at and stuff. But there were palm trees, like, everything was very coastal with the decorations and stuff. It was a very relaxed atmosphere. Everybody was friendly. Everything you needed was there for the big city, but without all of the skyscrapers, the crazy traffic, the noise, that aspect of it. But it's a very, very boating-friendly community. It's also a big hub for a lot of people that are coming back from cruising or leaving from cruising. That seems to be one of the destination points that a lot of people leave out of or come back to.
Yeah, I mentioned the sailing capital of Texas. But yeah. This area on the northern side of Galveston Bay, which sort of opens up into the Gulf of Mexico, which, you know, from a geography standpoint, is really close. It's a great jumping-off point to head to the Caribbean, right? A lot of people will, anywhere on the southern coast of the U.S. and the Gulf of Mexico, will sort of head over to Florida and then pop down the island chain, right? And that's the way a lot of people make the Caribbean trip from the States. And in that area of what they call Galveston Bay or Clear Lake, Texas, which is a whole series of lakes off of the northern part of Galveston Bay, there's probably 3,000 to 4,000 sailboats. We used to refer to it as the aluminum forest. You know, you drive down a road and you go up on a hill or a bridge or an overpass
and just mass lined
as far as you can see. So definitely a large sailing community. But it was wonderful. And to Deb's point earlier, it really catered to that community. So, you know, there were dealerships that sold inflatable dinghies, and there were tons of canvas shops and repair shops and outboard motor shops, and you know, all the yacht brokers are down there for sailboats, used boats and whatnot. Just really, really did cater to the boating community.
If you needed it for a boat, there was at least two or three people that did that type of business, from rigging, like Gil said, canvas work, to electrical work, to even bright work. They had several companies that they took care of all the teak and did all of that stuff for you. They had,
for people with more money than we had, we did all our own.
yeah. With it being such a busy place, is it somewhere that's difficult to get a mooring? Is it expensive? Or is it just turn up and you're fine?
You turn up and you're pretty much fine. I mean, you might
they
have...
There was no mooring.
Yeah, there was no mooring. But there was plenty of marinas with
and
slips.
Every marina had at least 15 transit slips that you could stay into.
And expensive ends up being a bit relative. You know, we actually thought it was a fairly good price. It was less expensive than it was for our slip on
lake
the
Louisville.
Lake. So,
yeah.
For example, you know, just kind of put in perspective, right? At the lake, you're paying about $450 a month or something like that for a 30-foot slip. When we moved to Kima, and we had a 40-foot slip or a 45-foot slip, whatever it was.
I think $290.
Yeah, so $290 there.
So it actually got cheaper to be on the coast than it was on the lake.
It did. I mean, the marina certainly had less amenities, but it was, you know, we could actually get out into the ocean as opposed to the lake where you never get.
Yeah.
So once you were there and the ocean's there calling you, how much more adventurous did you get?
Our first real adventure of doing any kind of ocean sailing was, you know, we'd sail the 30-foot boat out on Galveston Bay, and we just fell in love with it, right? From where we were down there, we'd hop out on the bay, and just in 10 minutes, we could be through Clear Lake out into the bay and sail all day in the bay. It was wonderful. So we did that quite a bit, and then when we started looking for the larger boat, right, the one we ended up finding was in Florida. It was in Panama City, Florida. Mm-hmm. So we bought the boat there, and we ended up sailing it back from Florida on our own. We had a couple friends that were going to join us for the trip, and kind of last minute, their plans changed just with work schedules and whatnot. And Deb and I were just so excited about it. We're like, we can do this, right?
We can do it.
We've certainly sailed before, and we have all our safety equipment. We'll be good. So our first real sort of ocean sail was just from Florida over to the sort of northern tip of the Gulf of Mexico. And then we went a good portion of that trip back on the Intercoastal Waterway, which is an inland waterway that's essentially protected by barrier islands. So you do a little bit of sea sailing, and then you come inside.
Basically, it's just a loop of body of water that you can actually go completely around the whole United States. And it varied, and the thing that shocked me the most, that going from state to state, I figured it would look the same, you know, water with buildings and stuff on side, but it really didn't. Like in Florida, you know, obviously you had the coastal people that had the houses with the landscaping in the backyard so that they could sit in the backyard and see it. Leaving Florida, going into Alabama, there was a thing that surprised me the most is there was just a dead stop between the nice crystal blue water to welcome to the Bayou Swampy area. you could see it coming when you left the blue water. I figured there'd be a gradual change to it. But then we got into more of the cypress trees, the marshy looking, you know, not so coastal looking like you see in Florida with all the homes and stuff. And then we got up into Louisiana with the bayou areas. You started seeing the homes, like, which we now living here have found that people call them fish camps. You know, you're like, that doesn't even look like somebody lives in it. It actually looks like it's like a weekend house. And it turns out that's what they are. You know, you'll be going down the intercoastal waterway dodging barges, and all of a sudden there's this, looks like somebody put a camper on a barge bed and just anchored it to the water. I mean, you have to drive a boat to get to it. And they were peppered all over the intercoastal waterway.
Yeah, the intercoastal is really a commercial. It's essentially, it was made, I think, just for commercial traffic primarily. Yeah. And it was, you know, as opposed to other parts of the world where you have a body of land and, you know, the sea is just kind of rolling in on it. This is, typically it's connected with a series of bays and rivers and then some man-made cuts and trenches. Some of it won't be very wide. It'll be maybe 100, 150 feet wide. And, you know, these barges will be able to pass one another on either side. And that's about it. It typically is about 12 feet deep, so 3 meters or so, not very deep.
There were times and we passed times barges. I swear I could hand something out my window right into theirs.
Yeah.
Close.
Could you go all the way through to, say, Chicago and the Great Lakes without great difficulty, you know, if you wanted to?
So it really runs along the exterior coast. So it runs from, you know, all the tip of Maine, the northern tip of Maine, all the way down to Florida. It kind of runs back up around the west side of Florida. There's a small section between where Florida kind of goes north and then turns west. There's a small section where there is an intercoastal there. You kind of cross the corner of the Gulf of Mexico. And then it runs all the way to the southern tip of Texas. So it runs that entire length. There's kind of a common cruising area in the U.S. They refer to it as the Great Loop, or they refer to people as loopers that have done it. And essentially, you go from that exact trip I just described, right, from the northern tip of the U.S. down the Atlantic seaboard during the ICW, across the Gulf of Mexico, you know, heading west, and then you go up the Mississippi River, and ultimately you make it up into the Great Lakes, and then you come through the chain of lakes east again, typically through New York, and it forms a giant loop on the eastern part of the United States. So that's something people do. Probably not something for a sailor. There's too many bridges that won't open, or, you know, a sailboat couldn't go up for that height. So people that do it will often take their mast down when they run from the Great Lakes south in the Mississippi until they get to the Gulf of Mexico.
Going back to your adventures, you told us about the first ocean voyage. Have you gone further afield since?
Yeah, we have. So we've done the Panama City, Florida to Texas. You know, we bounced around a little bit over the couple of years. So we went to Kima, Texas, and from there we did our boat refit. We then sailed to Corpus Christi, Texas, which was, you know, just a two-day sail to the southern tip of Texas. We stayed there for a few months. We came back up to the Kima area. It was another good place to be, so we came back to that particular area. And our plan was to sort of start heading east to Florida. So we probably would have, had we not bought the Formosa, we'd probably be in this area or further east by now.
I bet we'd be in Florida.
Yeah, we'd probably be in Florida by now, but we would have been heading east. Instead, we found the Formosa in New Orleans, so that's, you know, halfway between where we were in Kima and Florida. So that's where we are now, and we'll keep making our way east. So we've not done any tremendous ocean voyages at this point, and honestly, Deb and I don't intend to be circumnavigators. We enjoy the liveaboard community boating lifestyle, and we sort of expect that we will, especially while I'm working, we will spend, you know, we'd like to see it about 6 months in any one spot and then move on to another area. And I say one spot meaning a general vicinity. We might go to several different marinas or moorings over that period of time, but that's sort of our plan and our goal. And then the only other sailing experience we've had, you know, sort of ocean sailing, is we've chartered in the British Virgin Islands and really, really enjoyed that as well.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames. From the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures, I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places and boarding the ships that work this mighty muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.
This is Edward Smith from OPA Racing.
This is Ken Little, president of Glock Performance Boat Challenge.
Hi, this is Frank Pillsbury with Marine Max and the DFW International Boat Show in Dallas, Texas.
We explore all kinds of boating topics on Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show. Hi, I'm Captain Bob May. We get underway, making way, Saturday evenings here on Boat Radio.
This is Heather Lohe, Director of Membership for Boat US. Thanks for listening to Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm James Finlayson, and this is The Life Aquatic. Each week in this program, we'll talk to people who have left dry land behind and have committed to living their lives on a boat. Earlier in the program, we heard how Gillen Deblocker had started sailing on the lakes of Texas, but had eventually taken the plunge and started living on board full-time along the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. They've taken on the challenge of fixing up their Formosa sailing vessel Dream Chaser and documenting the process on their blog and in a series of YouTube videos. But after their impulse purchase of Dream Chaser, did they find that it needed more work than they expected?
Well, when we first got it, there was a couple major leaks that we knew were going to need our attention first.
Above deck leaks.
Above deck leaks that we needed to fix first, the obvious ones.
Are the two of you people who have to do everything yourself? Is that kind of in your nature, or will you go for help when you need it?
We'll go for help
when we need it, but part of me is I like the pride of looking at it going, I did that. And if I get to a point where I can't do it, then I go for help. And I was that way even when we were in the house, you know. And I think because my dad always fixed everything. He was really good at woodworking. And so we always fixed a lot of stuff ourselves. And part of mine is I've looked at work that other people have done, and I'm thinking, you paid that for it? I could at least do that good, if not better.
Yeah, James, we do most of it ourselves. And one of the things we found was nobody else cares for your vessel quite like you will, right?
Exactly.
And certainly there are things that we've run into that we just didn't have the skill to do, and we had to hire it out. And, in some cases I was thrilled with it. You know, we had a guy that did a lot of work for us. The guy was wonderful, and he would explain what he did, so I actually learned a little bit from him as well. And he really did tremendous work. So once you find somebody like that, you know, you hang on to their name and number, and you never want to let them go because others just don't care the same way you do. And what we found is every time we've had to rebuild or do some kind of work, we learned so much about it. And if we're going to live on the boat and we intend to cruise it like we do, we want to be able to fix anything that goes wrong. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's the refrigeration system, plumbing, the motor. Once you've torn it apart and worked on it yourself, you know it so much more intimately than you would otherwise. And so that's really been what fed us into wanting to do most of it ourselves. That and the money.
And you've obviously also shared a lot of that online as well, haven't you? Things that you've picked up about what you've done on the boat.
Yeah.
We have.
Yeah.
Mainly because when we were doing the Gulf Star, we were looking at it. And actually, the Gulf Star was kind of turned out to be a little bit more than we anticipated, because when we did the survey and we've started to fix the few things the surveyor said needed to be fixed, as we would pull off a piece of board or we would pull off the headliner, we found problems that you can't see. The surveyor couldn't see them because they were hidden behind things. So then after we did that a couple times, we said, okay, wait a minute, we really need to stop and look at this because there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes. So we always joke that on the Gulf Star, we actually saw more of the fiberglass than we ever anticipated on the inside.
You mentioned the way we do this work, and we even documented a lot. One of the things, when we first got the Gulf Star and started the refit, if there was something I looked at and I was like, geez, when I take this thing apart, whatever it happens to be, I think the first experience I had was I was going to rebed the ports. They were leaking on the side of the boat. And I looked all over online for how to do it. I wasn't really sure. I kind of had in my head how I'd do it, but I wasn't sure. So I went online and I couldn't find anybody that had like a YouTube video or a blog post that explained how to do it. So I thought, all right, well, I'm about to cut into this thing on my own, and it would make me feel a lot better if I saw what this would look like from somebody else before I cut my own boat, you know, cut a hole in something. So I went out there with my little $100 Walmart, Fuji camera, and I filmed everything I did, and then later kind of pieced it together and wrote a blog post with it and put some photographs around it. And from that point forward, anytime we went to look up how to do something on the boat, if we didn't find a how-to video somewhere, we tried our best to make one. And I don't know, for me, it was fun, and it kind of killed some time, and I enjoyed it. And I thought, if I just help one other person with maybe not even knowing that I did it the right way, but that here's what it looks like when you do it, it would help
and
people.
And for us, it was, we'd always say in the videos, too, we're not, you know, this is what we did. This has worked for us. May not work for you. If you've got a better way, please share it. You know, because we did find there were some people that had done repairs on the boats, but not necessarily documented it like we did. So we did have a couple people going, hey, next time you do this, you might want to try it this way. So we were finding avenues from people's comments on different ways to try to do things.
Was there one particular thing that got the biggest response or the biggest debate going?
Yeah, you know, it's funny.
Of
all the videos we have posted, the biggest response was this product called GitRot. They don't sponsor us, so there you go, GitRot. Have that. It's this penetrating epoxy that if you have some wood that has a rot in it, you can drill a series of small holes into the wood, into the core of the wood, and you run this penetrating epoxy into those holes. The idea is it absorbs into the loosely rotted wood. You know, obviously it's not going to fix a whole bulkhead or something, but a small area.
It's for small general areas that need to be fixing that you don't want to scarf out and replace.
And I'll say, that one video, it might represent 60% of our total traffic on the website.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So apparently there's a lot of wood rot out there that people look up.
There's some more jobs that have been big challenges as well.
Yeah, there were...
Morning, baby.
Sorry,
our little one just got up.
Okay.
So I'd say there's been a few that were pretty good-sized jobs. On this Formosa, one of the ones that was a pretty large job is when we first moved aboard, we wanted to replace the entire head, the bathroom. So we really liked something we had done on the Gulf Star, and that was put in a freshwater electric flushing toilet. So we went ahead and installed that with what they call Electrosan waste treatment system. So basically it works with a holding tank and can actually treat waste. So you don't always have to worry about where there's a pump out station. It fully treats it just like your municipal water supply would in the city you live in. So that was a big project. The other one was we noticed we had freshwater leaks in the boat. And by freshwater leaks, I mean once the water system for the showers and the bathrooms and the kitchen sink, once they were pressurized, they would leak and the water pump would run often. And as I started looking for these leaks, I just found the hoses to be a kind of a hodgepodge mess of years of patchwork. Initially it was copper lines. Then somebody had run some different flexible hosing. In some places I found regular garden hose you'd find at your local home supply store, hose clamped in. So that was another large project. We pulled all of the plumbing out of the boat, everything from a fresh water supply. So we put in all new lines, all new fittings, new hot water heater, all new fixtures in both the heads and the galley. And we also put in a water filtration system that will purify the water. You know, if we take water in from a marina or a fresh water supply, it'll purify that water. So it's a lot cleaner in the event that it's questionable when we take it in.
How old is the boat? Have you managed to trace the whole history of it?
It's a 1978, and it's actually been documented a good portion of her time that she's been in commission. So we do have owners and the names that it was called back to, I think, the 80s.
Yeah, we don't have the entire
we don't
history.
There's a couple of years that we're missing, but we have a good portion of it that we can tell where it was listed as far as registered and stuff like that. Now, we met two of the previous owners. The gentleman that we bought it from, he stayed friends with the guy that he bought it from. So, in fact, it was quite funny. We heard a lot of stuff about the boat talking to him prior to purchasing it that I think kind of made the broker cringe a little bit, because one of the things that we found out is the gentleman, the third owner before us, had passed away on the boat over in the Bahamas somewhere. And the broker was not made aware of this information. So when we went in to sign the paperwork on it and stuff, we were talking about it. I said, I'm going to try to look up and see what happened to the guy that died on the boat. And he looked at me kind of funny. I'm like, well, yeah, we were talking to the owner last night, and he brought over the guy that he bought the boat from. And he had bought it from the estate from the guy that had passed away on the boat. And he's like, I didn't know that. Okay. He goes, so, wow. And he just kind of sat there because I mean, for me, it wasn't a deal breaker because I'd been on the boat. I was fine with it. But I can see where some people would be like, yeah, that's not going
to
work for
me. Yeah, we were already emotionally committed to buying
it.
But from a history standpoint, it's a 1978 Formosa. It was a Bill Garden design boat. It was built in the Taxing Shipyard in Taiwan. So it was being built in 1977 and ultimately commissioned in 1978.
So would somebody have sailed it from Taiwan to the States, or was it transported?
You know, I suspect somebody sailed it. We don't know that for sure. I tried to find that out, and I couldn't find anything on it, just looking at, like, hull identification numbers. I know a lot of them have. We often joke that the boat's more capable than its skippers.
I was going to say, you know, if you should, you know, have a change of heart and suddenly feel adventurous, you could say take it all the way across the Atlantic or the Pacific, could you?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, it has made that before.
Yeah, the boat definitely has the capability to do that kind of sailing. I'd say we would need to reinforce some of the refit work we're doing. I mean, I'd obviously want to check the rigging before I ever did a, you know, an Atlantic crossing. I especially if I was going anywhere in northern latitudes in the Atlantic, over on your side there.
Yeah.
Your seas are a little rougher than ours here.
Yeah.
Do you think you ever would feel brave enough to, you know, make that great crossing? You know,
on a cruise ship?
Yeah. Nip says no, I don't know. I think I'd love to do it in the Caribbean sometime, and I don't have a big desire to cross the Atlantic and head that direction. If we were going to do it, maybe at some point across the Pacific into the Southern Pacific, that could be fun, but it's just not even on our, you know, our future storyboard, if you will. We're just saying we'd love to bounce around the islands in the Caribbean. It's, you know, bathtub sailing, as a lot of people refer to it, right? Not a lot of seas, you know, you certainly got to watch the tropical storms, and you got to be south of a certain latitude during that season, but...
So that future storyboard of yours, what else is on the storyboard?
Our storyboard for the initial next few years, we're really going to be work our way slowly east into Florida, continue to work and fund a cruising kitty and sock money away. We found a way of not having to retire to cruise. I mean, we kind of look at what we're doing as some kind of a hybrid cruising style now, where we live on the boat and we enjoy the marina live aboard lifestyle that we have. And we want to keep doing that while I'm working. Beyond that, it was going to be to sail on down into the island, sail down to the Caribbean. We'd love to head down to the Grenadines, love to spend some more time in Jamaica. We really enjoyed the BVIs. We expect that, you know, all the Virgin Islands would be wonderful to sail in, though it's expensive, so it's not a place that we'd likely stay for a long time. But yeah, that's really what the future one looks like for us, and it doesn't go beyond that. You know, there's a lot of what-ifs out there. We've thought about, you know, at some point maybe we sock enough money away and take a year or two sabbatical from work and maybe come back. You know, you just never know how long you'll want to cruise. A lot of the people I've spoken to have cruised, you know, they had a plan to cruise for 18 months or 24 months, and, you know, you talk to them and that was 8 years ago and they're still going.
Yeah. And, you know, if you look into that crystal ball in the future, do you see a bigger, more luxurious boat, a bigger U-shaped sofa maybe?
No. In fact, we've got the best of both worlds, because in the Formosa, when you first step down into the boat, you step into the galley kitchen area where it has a U-shaped thing, and then you take two steps down into the salon. So we actually have, you know, I tell people I have an eat-in kitchen. So I'm not eating in my living room like, you know, you do on some boats. But as far as you were saying about the plans for the future, obviously with the grandkids living with us, you know, that's changed a little bit with schooling. So one of the things we talked about doing was, we've actually tossed around the idea of maybe in a couple years homeschooling and taking the 10, which will be 12-year-old then, and going someplace for a year or two. But I think a lot of it's going to depend on how she feels about homeschool, how I feel about homeschooling her. You know, there's a lot of variables in that. But we figured if we could get to Florida, then, you know, during the summer months, we could take 3 months and, you know, we could do the BVIs in 3 months. We could go to Bahamas for 3 months in the summer. So it would be living aboard full-time, part-time cruising.
Okay. Could you tell us a little bit about the blog and what the address is?
Sure. So like I said, we started the blog initially for how we did certain projects, and then I found myself so often going to YouTube to see videos of things rather than do that. We sort of did both. Most of our blog posts are accompanied with a video that shows how we did it. And the name of our boat is Dream Chaser, so our blog is at SV for Sailing Vessel, dreamchaser.com. So svdreamchaser.com, or you can go to YouTube/SV Dream Chaser, and you'll see, like I said, a weekly update on whatever that project happens to be. So the latest ones have been that plumbing refit I mentioned, replacing the electrical head. We certainly do some on cooking aboard, because that's always interesting. How to provision, how to organize, you know, working on the dinghy. There's just a whole, whatever the job du jour happens to be, ends up being up there.
And one of the things I told Gil, now that the girls are with us, we're actually doing more fun stuff too. Just a couple months ago, we purchased a center cockpit dinghy, but a hard bottom dinghy that has, it's more rigid and it's a lot safer for the girls to go in. So we're definitely going to start doing some more videos that include, you know, hey, this is how we're doing it with the kids aboard, you know, so that it's not all work. There is some play in there too.
Right. And you hear the 2-year-old who's awake and joining us now.
This is Boat Radio, and you've been listening to Life Aquatic, featuring the story of Gil and Deb Lotka. To find out more about their life on board, and to find out how to fix lots of problems on your boat, you can visit their website at svdreamchaser.com.